Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong for over 43 years, and every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we collect in front of our radios to chat, to educate each other, learn from each other, and entertain each other. And I'm glad to be back. We took a couple of weeks off because of the holidays, and I hope everyone is well rested. I wish everyone a great 2024. And thanks for showing up for another episode of the Limark Technical Net. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual links. Okay, if you want to reach me via email, there are two different addresses you can use. Mailbag@ac2gs.com, or if you want, roy@limarktech.net. That would be either for questions that you can't ask during the technical net because you're not in radio range, or topics you would like to discuss or you'd like to hear discussed or be part of a discussion. Or if you have a TechNet puzzle, we're always looking for interesting puzzles. Or if you want to ask Paul a question, now you can get him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Also, we have a link page. We started a new one for 2024, but there are links to go back to 2023 and even back farther. Interesting articles, YouTubes and such that I've collected over the last week or so. You can get there by typing in either roy.ac2gs.com or links.limarktech.net. We have a chat room available. It's been rather quiet lately, but you can access it by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com or chat.limarktech.net. And we offer an audio stream of the Technical Net and of the Glen Oaks Repeater 24/7. You can get there by typing into your browser technet.ac2gs.com or stream.limarktech.net. And, of course, I'd like to remind people regularly of my KC2NJI's great archive site called amateurradio.tv. It has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So please avail yourself of that site. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you what I got planned. Okay. For the most part, we got a regular night planned. We will be asking for questions or topics or comments about technology. Hopefully, the first questions will be amateur radio related because we are an amateur radio technical net. But, you know, we are open to discussing any aspect of science and technology, and I look forward to interesting topics that people come up with. That should take us to approximately 10:15, and Paul, WS2N, will give us the SpaceNet report, and that should take us to about 11 o'clock p.m., in which I'll return and wish you all well and tie a little bow on everything and call it a night until next week. A little bit different. I have a very short topic before we get into the questions. If people want to talk about it, that's great. If no one wants to talk about it, that's okay. So let me drop for a second, then I'll go on with my first short topic for tonight. This week is a special week. I enjoy the Consumer Electronics Show at Las Vegas. They present new technology and things that you never knew that you wanted or needed, and oftentimes you never will want or need, but they present them nevertheless. Last year, they had more than a few disconcerting inventions that had to do with urinating on them to get measurements of some kind. Thankfully, that never took off. But every year they bring in the new flashiest televisions and try to promote something new. And in the good old days, I used to somewhat debate, Eric, because the television industry brought us 3D, which didn't really take off well, and 4K, which took off reasonably well, but, you know, I mean, it depends on your eyesight, I guess. And then the last time we discussed things, they were promoting 8K, and I thought that was somewhat overkill. He thought that it was a boon for the broadcasting industry. It kind of fizzled, unfortunately. So the question that I have for tonight is what Looney Tunes thing will the television industry, the manufacturers, be promoting for us to throw away our relatively new flat screen television and buy something new? So let me drop for a second and I'll tell you what my guess for the new glitzy thing is going to be. They tried resolution. 8K really, as far as I'm aware, didn't take off very well. And they certainly can't afford to increase the resolution anymore. So I think you're going to see this week a lot of televisions promoting their illumination. They measure illumination in units called nits. Your television and my television probably puts out about 500 nits. The high dynamic range televisions that they've been promoting for a while usually put out 1,000 or 1,500 nits. My guess is that they're going to be promoting 4,000 nits, which is a very bright screen. This is not a screen that you need to darken your room. You could open up all your blinds, let the sun shine in on it. Also, it probably will give people eye pain if it goes for the whole 4,000 nits. So that's my guess for this week, that you're going to hear about very, very, very bright televisions. So that's the next aspect of TV technology, and we'll see if I'm correct. Anyone with any comments before we move to the question section?
U.S. to West.
Yes, Paul.
Very good. And by the way, Happy New Year. The TV that they're talking about, are they going to be OLEDs? Because from what I see there, out of the whole group, you know, if you walk through let's say a Costco store that has them all on display, I see that OLED is best by far. So, I mean, is that going to be like the bench level, and then they're just going to go with that and just improve it, get 4,000 nits?
No, unfortunately, this is probably being engineered by companies like Sony that don't have OLED manufacturing in their business model. There's only, I think, one OLED manufacturer other than China is still kind of working on it, and that's Samsung Display, which is different than Samsung. They kind of split the company in half. This 4,000 nit thing, I think, is going to be an OLED killer because the nature of organic light-emitting diodes kind of limits the for something like $20,000. The way that they do it is they use a technology called mini LEDs, which are semiconductor LEDs. They're not micro LEDs, so you can't just use each LED per pixel as you do for organic light-emitting diodes. So what happens is it's a regular liquid crystal display, probably with quantum dot enhancements, and behind it is a tight array of a lot of micro LEDs that are capable of throwing a lot more illumination than organic light emitting diodes.
Hey, very interesting. The I figured the LCDs were going to be gone, and everything was going to be built around the theory of OLED with each pixel lighting up with nothing behind it. But I guess not. I wonder how many nits an old-fashioned CRT, you know, good color TV is. Because, you know, I still have a couple of them. I have a couple of them actually hooked up to broadcast TV now. Put that on. That screen is so bright. you know, I'm just wondering what, I guess I can find it on the internet. How many nits is a good quality CRT? It's, you know, you just can't beat that. It's a lot better than my regular LCD Vizio. Back to you.
Well, I mean, have you seen the organic light emitting diode displays? They're very nice. They're very expensive, unfortunately. And the companies that manufacture them don't make as much as a profit margin as the companies that do LCDs do. But they have very nice dynamic range. They have really, really dark blacks. Eventually, my guess is the technology will eventually evolve as they are capable of producing mini LED displays now. They'll shrink them eventually to micro LEDs, and each pixel will probably be an addressable solid-state LED capable of a lot more illumination. That will probably be it until someone discovers either some other weird technology or develops truly holographic displays where you get these volumetric displays where it isn't pseudo 3D, it's real perceived three dimensions.
Okay, it sounds good. We'll look forward to it. And yes, I've seen the OLEDs. Like I said, if you walk to a Costco near me, they must have 20 sets that are, you know, different sets. You know, from your standard LCDs, to the OLEDs, everything, different, couple of different brands. So you get to see a good comparison, different size screens and all. And by far, the OLEDs are the best. And a couple of other ones are catching up, though, from what I noticed. But I don't think they're going to be the OLEDs for a while. And also, longevity, I've heard that the OLEDs, they believe they are going to start lasting longer than the regular LCDs. Only time will tell, of course. But that's important. You know, you out blow that kind of money on a TV, probably easily twice or three times more than a regular LCD. You're going to want it to last. Back to you, Roy. WS2S.
AC2GS. Yeah, I don't think the longevity issue of the organic light-emitting diodes is going to be better than LCDs. What happened was originally the organic light-emitting diodes, the first design were red, green, and blue. And the blue dyes, for some reason, were very sensitive and deteriorated first. So you had a degradation of the color image, the blue failing. I think nowadays, especially with quantum dots, what they do is they build organic light-emitting diodes that all emit the same ultraviolet emissions, and then they have the quantum dots, red, green, and blue, doing the color selection and such. So the colors are a lot more stable than the early generations of organic light-emitting diodes. As far as the nit emissions of cathode ray tubes, they were decent, but you have to keep in mind that the surface areas of cathode ray tubes are much smaller than flat-screen televisions are today. I mean, I had a monster of a cathode ray tube television that was, I think, 36 inches diagonal. Those things weighed a ton. Most people had much smaller sets, and so if you figure it out for the area and such, I would assume that it was anywhere from 50 nits to maybe about 300 nits. For their resolution, Trinitrons were beautiful screens, but there was no way that you were going to turn them into 4K displays and the size that flat screens are today. It would be a mechanical marvel to behold.
Very good. Your big screens in the old science fiction movies, 1984 movie or Star Trek movies, they had the big screens. But they were all probably projectors, I guess. Anyway, we'll turn it back to you, Roy. Oh, by the way, the all LEDs on my watch, I mean, takes a lot of abuse. So, that, I mean, that's a lot for the all LEDs. Back to you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they give you a beautiful image. I have an iPhone that's OLED based, and you can tell just by looking at the blacks are actually black. Because LCDs have a certain number of pixels that they light from behind. So if all the pixels are supposed to display black, they can turn off the addressable background LEDs, and it gets nice and black. But in areas that they have to light up a few pixels, they can't black out the background, and so it becomes a kind of mottled grayish problem. So as they shrink the size of the LEDs and increase the number of the background LEDs, that'll be less and less obvious, and eventually the imagery will kind of merge with similar to organic light emitting diodes. Yeah, it's a nice time to be alive. Technology is always improving. I don't think there's a big need for very bright screens, but we'll see. Maybe they'll get away with it. Maybe they'll cause all of us to throw our old TVs away and buy 4,000 nits. It's not going to come tomorrow, though, because, like I said, Sony just announced a studio, a professional version of a monitor like that, and I think they want something like $20,000. So it's going to take time for the industry to gear up to higher and higher illuminations. If there's an interest, we'll see. Anyone with any other comments before we come on with questions? Go on with questions tonight. Okay.
This is Kilo Echo 2, Alpha Juliet Uniform, letting you know that I'm listening. Roy, I'm Charlie Nelly.
Okay, very good, Charlie. Glad to have you aboard. We will move on to the usual section, questions. And as always, I would prefer if the first few questions are amateur radio related. But as I said, as time goes on tonight, we're certainly open to any kind of aspect of science and technology. So it's open for discussion. Anyone out there want to throw their call sign and first name on the list for tonight for questions, comments, or topics?
Oh, Roy, I got a question. This is Charlie. How can we get cable for free? It's expensive.
Well, that would probably be a case of theft. In the old days, unfortunately, for the cable company, theft was incredibly easy. If you had a neighbor who had cable and you weren't adverse to knowing how to splice cables together, all you had to do was connect your cable from your house to his house, and the set-top boxes had no authentication. Nowadays, it's nothing but digital streams and authentications, and it's much, 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 much more difficult to get away with free cable, as far as I'm concerned. Most people who get away with things usually get away with streaming services. They invariably have friends and relatives who actually subscribe to the streaming service, and they offer them their password, which the streaming services are very unhappy with. But I think that's where most theft of streaming services comes from, the misuse of accounts and passwords.
I mean, back when we were kids, TV was free.
Well, theoretically, broadcast television is free, although we've mentioned before that a new television broadcast standard called ATSC 3.0 was just brought online. About 4 months ago, it was brought online in Philadelphia. About a month or two ago, it was brought online in New York City. There are some people with televisions that can't quite get the channels that they once wanted to have. They've moved them around a little bit. So theoretically, if you have a bunch of rabbit ears and are so inclined, you should be able to get broadcast television still. It's the people that want cleaner reception and don't want to put up aerials who used to invest in cable. And sometimes I invested in cable many years ago, and I moved from cable to DirecTV satellite, which was very good in its time, except when it rained or snowed. The water would kind of block the signals from the satellite. And since then, I've moved to fiber optic internet service and streaming services. So I don't have a cable anymore, and I don't have aerials. But Paul listens to broadcast television. There used to be a time that the very beginning of the technical net was often brought up subjects about broadcast television. And, of course, Eric, who was a television engineer, would put in his expertise to discuss it. So there are ways of getting some things for free, just not as many as people would want.
Okay, Roy, thank you.
You're welcome, Charlie.
2VHD.
Yes, Jim.
Hello, Roy. Interesting stuff. I was trying to get through on my HD, but that wasn't working, so I jumped over to the base unit. Interesting conversation. Comment on the high brightness TVs. I'm not an early adopter of fancy AV equipment, if that's even a term anymore. But I relish the idea of not having to have a special room with special blinds and you know, in the basement to view content on a big screen. So I think that there's a lot of practicality towards spending a few extra bucks on a TV rather than having to have many more bucks on a special room or special shades to work it in. Any feedback on that?
Well, you know, I mean, if you're talking about older flat screens, I would agree with you, although the newer ones are rather well designed. Some of them are capable of 1,000 nits, which is a fair amount of illumination. Theoretically, I think displays that were meant for outdoors start at around 600 nits or so it's possible to get enough illumination. And the anti-reflection coats on a lot of flat-screen televisions can be very annoying. Just yesterday was Ham Radio University, and our own Ed, WB2EAV, who hopefully will be showing up a little bit later here on the technical net, did a presentation on calibration equipment. And I did the same type of a presentation with good old Andy, WA2CDL, about 5 years ago. And the annoying thing that I noticed was I couldn't use my pointer. The LCD, the flat screen LCD that was supplied in the different rooms, had anti-reflection layers that were so good that it didn't reflect my laser pointer at all. So I think modern flat-screen TVs it's not that necessary to darken the room. In the old days when there was, projection televisions or back projection televisions and such, that was certainly a significant problem. But I don't think they're quite a problem anymore.
They certainly have come a long way, and I enjoy that about it the most, that you don't have to have a dedicated room or a dedicated section of your house to do to do high-quality video display. I've seen the OLEDs in the stores, most impressive. I don't have one as of yet, but they seem to get that goal. Probably one of the best things that's happened to the video displays. TV, on the other hand, I cut the cord. It ain't worth watching. That's another discussion, though.
Yeah, software versus hardware. I have my own petty little theories that creativity and mastering of the art of drama is a limited asset, and there's just too much hours to fill and channels to fill. And if you spread your good artists too thin, you get a lot of third-rate garbage. And I think that's what's going on personally. But, yeah, It's, even LCDs. The technology has improved dramatically with quantum dots that we talked about here a year or two ago. And the price points have plummeted. I mean, the price of a moderately large LCD flat screen TV is a dream I was surprised the first time I saw the prices plummet. On a good sales day, you can get a decent technology flat screen TV for a couple hundred bucks, which is amazing to me because I remember the good old days where you had to pay a lot more for them.
No doubt. It's definitely a huge improvement. And like I said, the biggest thing is for most of us, or probably all of us, how much it impacts us varies, but our real estate is much more expensive than our TVs. And if our TV can take up less real estate and not consume a room visually or socially or mechanically, it's a vast improvement in our world. So that's... I'm thrilled that technology is going that way.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I mean, I went through different stages. I mentioned that I had, right before cathode ray tubes kind of went out of fashion, I got myself a 36 diagonal, which had to weigh 200 pounds and took up a lot of space. And I replaced that with a rear projection flat screen. It was actually a light box. So even though it was mostly empty as opposed to my cathode ray tube, which was mostly glass, it was lighter to move around, but it took up almost the same volume. And now they have things that you could just kind of tack on the wall like a painting. It's, I am amazed by the advance of modern technology, and they're always working on making it better. So that's another great thing. So who knows what will be available 10 years down the road. We probably don't have the imagination to come up with a good idea. Everyone who tries to guess the future starts to sound to me like old articles I read in Popular Science in 1960.
That the flying cars will be here any day now. Yep. So it's definitely come a long way. And thanks for the opportunity to kick in on that. Back to that, you probably need to get on to the next topic. Thank you.
Okay, very good, Jim. Well, once again, I'm AC2GS, and this is the Limewalk Technical Net. And, we're here to hear your questions or comments or topics. We don't have anyone on the list at this point, so if people want to volunteer and go on the list for tonight, feel free.
All right, I'll go for it. KD2VHD, Jim at Bayport. I got a ham radio related question.
Okay, Jim, let it rip. I don't know exactly what happened. Maybe after 2 weeks, everyone's gotten out of practice here, but hopefully they'll get back into the rhythm. So what's your question for tonight, Jim?
So in regards to wire for HF dipoles and such, I've been playing around with the copper fishing line about 1 millimeter in diameter, and I like it a lot. But it has the problem that it corrodes over time, and so if you want to vary your arrangement, you don't get a sure contact to it. And I recognize that it seems like the market is cheaper now to have a similar size stainless steel, which has some advantages of its own, but it doesn't get corroded as much, so you can vary your connection to a wire much more readily. Is there any downside signal-wise, RF-wise, to using a stainless steel cable, 1 millimeter diameter or so, versus other more commonly used antenna materials?
Yes, there's insertion loss. We talked before about radiation resistance, which is a good thing. It's the virtual resistance rather than... where the energy is used up as loss heat, it's used up as radio wave emissions, which is what we want. So in a perfect world, your antenna would have 100% radiation resistance and zero waste heat thermal resistance. The problem with stainless steel is that it's not as good a conductor as copper is. And that's why very often you can see companies that sell different types of wire will feature a copper-clad stainless steel wire where it benefits from the sturdiness of the stainless steel, but still because it's clad in copper, you have the skin effect basically giving you the same resistance as if it was a pure copper wire. I would suggest if you're concerned about tarnishing of the copper, you consider probably an insulated wire rather than stainless steel. Also, stainless steel is probably a little bit more difficult to handle. It tends to have a kind of springy nature. So one of the many beauties of copper is the ductility that, you know, you can kind of mold it into any shape that you want to and it doesn't fight you. So I would strongly advise against stainless steel as an antenna wire and suggest looking into different types of insulated copper wires.
I completely agree for a permanent or semi-permanent installation, but I'm thinking more in terms of a wire on a reel that you can just reel out as much as you want, clip an alligator clip onto it. And if you clip an alligator clip onto a, you know, a tarnished piece of copper, I don't see a good RF connection there at all. But on a stainless steel wire, that could be something. So from a versatility standpoint, I'm looking for. And like I said, it sounds like at the market now, stainless steel is quite competitive in price-wise. So that's what I was thinking about.
Okay, I guess so. If you're willing to eat the thermal resistance insertion loss, you know, I mean, everything is a compromise. You're kind of suggesting what you did a while ago, and as I mentioned before, there's a company called Step IR. That you should, you know, certainly don't consider buying their antennas because they're lovely antennas, but they're incredibly expensive. But investigate the materials that they use for a similar purpose. As far as I recall, I don't remember the alloy that they use, but I remember it wasn't stainless steel. It was somewhat more esoteric. So, it might give you an idea. I assume that it's not, the same material is not readily available at Home Depots and such, because it's a little bit more esoteric than stainless steel. But, you know, I mean, no one says that you have to have the least resistant, the least loss antenna. If problems with the construction of your planned antenna warrant something that's, that, you know, won't is more corrosion resistant, then sure, have fun, experiment, and come back and tell us how it worked out.
I will. As I've probably mentioned in the past, I tend to value utility and versatility more than ultimate high performance. And if I could take a piece of stainless steel and clip a lead on it here or there or the other place and reel up the stump on a reel and make one wire do a bunch of things, that really intrigues me.
Yeah, well, I mean, like I said, it's not completely a new idea. Step IR uses it, that's the principle. For Yagis and for other structures where they have stepper motors that feed out these strips of metal that change the geometry of Yagis and other types of antennas. And the people who use them love them, and since they cost so much, one assumes that there's a return on that investment with the people who've bought those antennas. But, you know, if you have nothing better to do, again, not to push buying any of them, but just to look at their technology, it's very similar to, I think, what you have in mind.
I will, and thank you. Back to that.
Doggy Dog, once again, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Limark Technical Net. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. usually, except for sundry holidays that might get in the way. So once again, if anyone is out there and wants to put their name on the list for questions or topics or maybe they've discovered something that they would like to share with the rest of us. So if you're out there and so inclined, hit that push to talk, give me your first name and your call sign.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I just want to let you know that the straight key night on January 1st, you know, they run that for 24 hours. It's still alive and well. And, you know, if you're not into CW, you know, you pretty much don't even realize that these things are out there. But, you know, I got on, and I could not believe how crowded it was. It seemed like millions of people out there with straight keys doing that during that day. But it's alive and well. You know, I have a setup. I have a regular iambic key, you know, a normal key, but it's hooked up in parallel to an old Radio Shack, you know, straight key. So I could just switch back and forth, you know, I leave like that all year round. So it's really easy for me to do it. I don't have to hook anything up. And, you know, most of the races on straight key night. But it's pretty cool. It's not really looked at as a contest, you know, with how many you can make. They want you to try to make at least one contact and go as long as you can. You know, 20 minutes, a half hour, whatever it takes with one contact. That's the kind of goal that they look for straight key night. That's it. Back to you, Roy. I don't know if anybody here has done it, but it is a lot of fun if you do get involved with CW. They go at fast paces and slow paces, and which is very good. Back to you.
Yeah, great. I follow reports of Straight Key Night. QST writes about it regularly. I've intermittently tried to learn Morse code, and unfortunately I can't consistently continue. I get distracted and move on to something else, and when I come back, I've pretty much forgotten all that I learned. So, you know, it's on my list with a bunch of other things. But one of the things that I'm glad happened when the FCC finally decided to discontinue the Morse code requirement, there was a lot of outcry from some people that this was going to be the end of Morse code as we know it, that if the young whippersnappers didn't need it to pass their license, they would have nothing to do with it. And I think it's been the exact opposite. I think the sales of keys have, if anything, gone up over the last two decades. There's the our own local Long Island, the Morse code club, CW club, and there's a lot of people doing CW. So I'm glad you enjoyed yourself. You know, straight key. I found straight key to kind of hurt my wrist after a while. I when I was learning, I learned originally on a straight key, and then I moved over to iambic paddle, and I found the iambic paddle to be orders of magnitude easier on my wrist.
Oh, you're 100% right. There's no way in the world I would do straight key day after day. I pretty much do it either for straight key night on January 1st, or if I'm on CW and somebody, you know, you can tell they're new, and you know, you want to slow down. They want you to slow down. Just as easy for me to just switch over to the straight key, because you can really go slow with that. But that's why I like having it hooked up all the time, and I can switch back and forth. But one thing about CW too, sometimes it's very hard to get wideband contact. You know, you're trying to work, you know, a rare station somewhere, and there's a mob, and they're trying to get through, and they're running 1,000 watts, and you're sitting there barefoot. But with a CW, for some reason, no matter what it is, you know, you're at the DX station, and give it time, and you pretty much get through, like, I would say, like, most of the time. Anyway, I do. But that's the one good thing about it. Back to you.
Yeah, it's a much more efficient, people regularly say this is the first digital data mode. It's very efficient. You take the amount of energy you're using and you spread it over the bandwidth. And the bandwidth for CW is much more narrow than say, single sideband. I'm just curious, do you have any opinions about bugs? I've never been a fan of, I've never even tried a bug. It struck me as, you know, kind of half of this and half of that, and, you know, more of a challenge than a benefit.
Yeah, I've seen them at different field day sites, and I'm very happy with the iambic here. You know, it's just so much easier for me to do that. And you said you've tried that as well. You know, there's nothing like it. You don't even have to necessarily do the iambic. Iambic is, you hold it with one hand, and it'll repeat, dot, 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 and you hit the other side, and you'll hear dot, dash, dot, dash, dot, dash. You know, you want to do a period, that it's quick, and it's easy, but you don't have to go by that. You know, you could just use it normally, you know, just send out regular letters. You hear it going as you're transmitting. So that it makes it quite easy. But side to side is the way to go. Straight key is very difficult for me. But I do it, you know. But again, you're going slow. There's no way you're going to go, 15 words a minute or more with a straight key. I'm not, anyway. There are guys that do it. Back to you.
AC2GS. Yeah, when I was using the iambic, I tend to use it as a side swiper. Which isn't quite the full feature set of iambic where you can get it to do strings and alternates and all kinds of things. So, there's the term sideswiper, which is kind of what I would just swing it from left to right and put out the letters as best I could. As long as you have an automatic keyer, it does most of the work for you as far as the timing goes.
99% of the time, I do the exact same thing you're doing, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, side swipers are loads of fun. I've never invested in, Bugalli keys. Beautiful keys. Expensive keys, but beautiful keys.
I'm just happy with an old Radio Shack key. I have a couple of other ones from, that I really dated, but if it works, that's it. And a signal is a signal. So it's simple, easy to adjust. I can change the speed on it. You know, it's a very, very good key that Radio Shack made years ago. A lot of these people make their own key. This one guy, I forget his call. Ken would know his call. You go to field day, and this guy makes his own key. What a beautiful work of art this thing is. Big, heavy metal brass thing. It's incredible. There are people that do that. Not me. Back to you, Roy.
WD2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
My father went to Italy to get the key I now use.
Is it any particular brand or just a craftsman from Italy?
Nah, he pulled the J-38 out of the P-24 after the war ended.
Ah, very good. I was going to ask Paul if he has a J-38. I do. I got it off of eBay.
The J-38. do not. I've seen it operated many times, but I do not have that right.
Oh, okay. I mean, it was probably the most manufactured straight key during World War II. I think mine is made by Lionel, you know, the people better known for toy trains and such. Anyway, anyone else out there who enjoyed Straight Key Night wants to tell us about it, the joys of CW?
Hey, Roy.
Yes, Paul?
The one guy I contacted was, he's got one radio after the other, different bands, all homebrewed. I mean, you know, and then I went to his website. It didn't look like he had one store-bought radio. I mean, he literally built, every, you know, 17-meter radios and, you know, all these different radios. It's you know, he did have a Drake. He did have a Drake, Drake 2B, and that's what he contacted me on. But, I mean, some of these people are just super talented. I couldn't believe it. All out of wood boxes, and then, you know, he shows the inside. Just incredible. Back to you.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's fewer and fewer of those guys. They're turning into silent keys. You know, it's modern technology. You know, the craftsmanship of design is kind of gone. Younger hams that are into building things, you know, they don't kind of build it for beauty. They sort of build it for functionality. There's a bunch of guys down on 75 meters working on digital transmitters for amplitude modulation and all kinds of really interesting stuff. But, you know, I don't think they're building it out into wooden cases anymore. They're too busy kind of finessing the technology. It's a shame because it's another sign of a culture that kind of existed and is slowly fading away.
Yeah, I concur. But yeah, and if anybody wanted to see what his website looks like, his name is Bill from Virginia, and his call is N2CQR. And N2CQR. Bring that up, and you could really see this guy. I don't know, he must have had a lot of time on his hands to do this. Incredible. It was like a world traveler, too. Quite a good guy. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
Okay, I'll have to take a look at that. I'm sure it's going to be fascinating. Thank you, Paul, for bringing that up. Ed, you just heard little while ago, Ed did a presentation yesterday at Ham Radio University. I'm curious if there's anyone out there who attended Ham Radio University and would like to tell us how they found this new in-person edition. Because of COVID, unfortunately, they went virtual. I attended and was part of Ham Radio University the last time it was in person. Me and Andy, WA2CDL, did a presentation on calibration equipment, and Ed has continued the tradition, and I'm just curious if anyone out there who attended HRU would like to mention how they found it.
BHG, I did not attend, but I am very sad that I didn't. I had a dental issue I had to take care of. I was very looking forward to it.
I'm sorry you missed it, Jim. I am particularly sorry that the powers that be didn't finesse videotaping, or actually just video recording these days, Ed's talk and such. I would have really enjoyed watching it on YouTube. I had the benefit of going through his PowerPoint slides and You know, I would have liked to have heard him do the actual presentation, but I guess it just wasn't to be. I wonder how much, if anything, of Ham Radio University was recorded yesterday and will be available hopefully soon on YouTube. But I doubt that Ed knows those things, and the people who run HRU, I assume, are doing something else tonight other than listening to me.
Hey, Roy, I wanted to go WS2N, but COVID had a different idea for me for that. What are you going to do? At least I got over it, but I would have contaminated half the place. I went to the very first one, and the last couple of ones I did on Zoom, which was great. So I hope they do have some kind of recordings of yesterday. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I do as well. I thought I read something that some of the presentations would be recorded and available. So I guess time will tell. If Ham Radio University has a YouTube channel, I would suggest people subscribe to it and click the little notification button. And so if they do load it up, you'll hear from them. Interesting. I've seen some things. I don't know. The virtual version, I don't know. It almost seems as though you're just watching another YouTube, which, you know, it's kind of easy to do. There's something special about an in-person presentation, especially where you get to ask questions and sometimes reflect and deflect the topic a little bit, unfortunately, you know, in real time. That makes it more of an actual course situation. But, you know, I am glad that they're back to in-person presentations. I hope they invest some time and effort in recording these things for posterity. You never know when you might want to brush up on a topic. And some of the people doing presentations were very knowledgeable, especially the ones I attended. So we'll see.
I got to ask questions live when it was on Zoom last year and the previous year. But, I mean, it's not as good as being there, but it's pretty close to the same idea. You know, they get to the end. Any questions? I got a question then. So, you know, I mean, it's doable, but like you said, it's not like being in person.
Yeah, I mean, I hold meetings using Zoom, and it's fine. It's very convenient. And if the one thing that COVID has made us realize is that there's a lot of convenient ways of doing things. I think it suits the concept of a university better to be in person and you raise your hand and even in the middle of a presentation, I'm sure Ed had some people kind of deflect the topic a few times during the actual presentation. That's what in-person people tend to do. Zoom tends to act as an isolating device where people are a little bit less likely to just raise their hand and, I have a question type of thing, and they'll wait for the end, which is a kind of a different environment. So we will see what happens. Anyway, I hate to sound kind of redundant, but if anyone out there has any questions or comments or a topic for discussion tonight, preferably something amateur radio related, but we're open to anything else, please hit that push to talk.
HD, comment?
Certainly, Jim.
It's interesting the interplay, the contrast, the difference between the in-person Ham Radio University, which I'm looking forward to attending and haven't had a chance to yet. I really intended to go the other day and it did not work out. But I've come up with this phrase having to do with other things, but I'll throw it out at this juncture because it seems appropriate. There's something to be said for socially close, physically distant. We do it all the time on radio. It's just second nature. It's what it is all about. Zoom and all these other platforms are, you know, have commonalities, but no, nothing replaces the human interaction. There's no doubt.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Matter of fact, if you ever kind of look into the sociological situation going on with young people, they tend to call themselves Zoomers, Generation Z. There's a lot of loneliness in that community. There's a lot of isolation. They have virtual meetings. They have interactions with sundry games that they play online on the internet, but I don't think it takes the place of human contact. And yeah, as you mentioned, amateur radio, we used to make a joke with COVID that amateur radio was the first socially distancing technology, because you couldn't catch any virus from anyone on your microphone and such. But I think it's afflicting a lot of young people. There's a lot of isolation, I understand, and there's a lot of young people kind of disengaged from the world around them. They're working jobs virtually. They're sitting in their rooms and ordering DoorDash.
Your comments bring to mind an interesting thought. This is unprepared. Just sprung into my mind as you said that. But it's often there's a social distance between kids and grandparents. And yet, in this age, it seems like they both find themselves in a place that's more similar than it has been in the past, as far as the isolation. And maybe that can be made to work for good. It's a creative license is given to it. It's an uncurated thought. It just occurred to me as you spoke.
Well, you know, in the really old days where families lived really together, where it was not unusual to have three generations in the same house, I think there was different dynamics. It's seldom a case, as far as I'm aware, where grandparents live in the same house as their children's families. And there's unfortunately these cultural divides, although we're all humans and people are in the same family. They have different attitudes to so many different things. It's kind of easy to have generational arguments than any other way of separating groups. So, you know, older people tend to be more conservative. Younger people tend to be more progressive. And there's a lot of problems with having a conversation that doesn't turn into yelling and screaming and such. So although I would like that to be the case, I think young people could learn a great deal from their parents and grandparents. Unfortunately, when you're young, you have this strange idea that you're the smartest guy in the room. So, you know, and it goes back generations. I remember old comedians who said, you know, I was amazed when I grew older how much smarter my father was than I remembered him when I was younger. So, you know, I would hope that would be a means to more social interaction. I don't know if you can engineer something like that. I think there are problems, you know, kind of arranging that, unfortunately.
WB2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
Yeah, I am an active Boy Scout leader, and I have noticed something. When new Boy Scouts come in 11 years old, they're absolutely convinced I'm a doddering old fool. But by the time they start high school,
They're amazed how much I've learned.
Yes, yes, this is very, very common.
I concur.
Usually, in my experiences, there is nothing more arrogant than